Hello, this is Terry Burdick reading to you from the Commercial News, the weekend edition for Saturday and Sunday, June 14th and 15th. First of all, I'd like to start off wishing all of you dads out there a very happy Father's Day. I hope you were well celebrated. And we'll talk a little bit more about Father's Day as we go through the paper today. As you can imagine, it has found a prominent space in our paper. But we're going to start on the first page today with a spoonful of humor, a heap of care. Danville teen cancer-free thanks to St. Jude's. And this comes to us from reporter Kayla White. When Danville High School student Sophia Osterber, 15, and her friends would prepare to take the stage at their show choir competitions last school year, they had a unique ritual. During show choir, my friends would rub Johnny for good luck. When we didn't do as well, Osterber said, laughing. Johnny is not a pet, a stuffed animal, or even a rabbit's foot. No, Johnny is the name Osterberg gave to the cancer cyst that had been growing on her right forearm before it was removed by surgeons at St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee last month. Now that Johnny, which is about the size of a gumball, is gone, Sophia, who goes by Sophie, and her older sister Emma remember him with a pink gravestone they made of clay. I never thought Johnny would hurt me, Sophie said, deadpan. This dark sense of humor is what kept Sophie and her family going through what was a scary, uncertain time, said her parents Katie and Colin. Finding the lump. An otherwise bubbly, bright young woman, Sophie's thoughts are usually occupied by school, show choir and palmettes, plans with friends, and spending time with her two family dogs, Oscar and Ralphie. But when she noticed a soft cyst just beneath the skin on her arm growing bigger and bigger earlier this year, she began to worry. It didn't hurt, and her friends thought it was funny, but even they admitted it was time to get it checked out. When Sophie initially showed her mother Katie the strange bump on her arm a few months ago, Katie thought nothing of it. But when it continued to grow, she made an appointment with the family dermatologist. They were pretty confident it was a cyst based on the feel and look of it, Katie said. Still, the dermatologist wasn't comfortable removing the cyst in the office due to the possibility of scarring and concerns that there may be blood flow to the cyst, so an ultrasound was scheduled. When the scans showed it was likely a harmless cyst, Sophie went in for a simple surgery to remove it. But her surgeon, Dr. Dominguez at Carl Hospital, sent the cyst in for biopsy just to be extra sure. Less than a week later, the biopsy results came back. That's when Dr. Dominguez called and said it was cancer, Katie said. The initial gut punch. The specific form of cancer Sophie had, a pleomorphic dermal sarcoma, PDS, is very rare, they were told. PDS is a soft tissue growth beneath the skin that is almost always seen on elderly individuals, particularly on areas that are exposed to the sun. These tumors have a potential to metastasize or spread to other parts of the body, and they grow rapidly. They can sometimes be difficult to distinguish from other skin tumors. Still, considering how rare PDS is, the team was not convinced of the diagnosis, so Sophie and her family were sent to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Peoria for a second opinion. After assessing the situation, the oncologist there recommended sending the tumor to St. Jude in Memphis, Tennessee, for a full pediatric pathology report. 2 weeks later, their worst suspicions were confirmed. Sophie indeed had cancer. As a mom, your job is to always protect your kids. You do whatever you can to protect them, and you make sure they're safe, Katie said. And so hearing the words, your kid has cancer, was really hard. When Katie got the phone call, Sophie was at school. I spent about the next 5 or 6 hours just melting down, and it was just incredibly scary because it's the unknown. You don't know, Katie said. As for Colin, the first day was especially hard. It was really a whirlwind. I think the not knowing was the hardest part, Colin said. Katie's a wreck and our parents are a wreck. Everybody's just devastated, you know? So I tried to stay like the optimistic part of it, like it's okay. We're going to take this one day at a time. Everything's okay, but we really didn't know anything. We had 48 hours of not knowing anything, and that's a lot of hours in that situation, Colin added. Emma, who was completing her final months of her high school education, was also impacted by the news. Sophie was shaken up. It was hard to hear that news, and then as a bigger sister, I feel like I want to make her feel better. So we went on a drive for about 2 hours, and we were listening to Fight Song, Emma said. It was hard to deal with it, but making her happy made it easier, like seeing her be able to joke about it. Sophie's grandmother had a hard time handling the news as well. Grandma came running in and she gave me a hug and I've never seen her cry and she started crying. She's like, we're not going to waste a day. And I was like, oh my God, when am I dying? Like, what's the cutoff? I was so scared, Sophie said. an extra helping of humor. When Katie delivered the news to Sophie later that day, Sophie handled it in the way she handles most hard things in life, with an extra helping of humor. I sent my friends a photo of me with a bald cap filter with a caption that said, "There's something I gotta tell you," she said, laughing. Mom was so mad. Katie said it wasn't anger as much as shock that she felt. "I was never angry about the jokes. They're triggering. You hear them and you're just like, oh my God," Katie said. Still, she understands and appreciates her daughter's manner of coping. She's brought a lot of light and joy to the situation, and that wasn't on her to do so. But that's the way she copes, Katie said. It was inspiring to see her sense of humor, like seeing her coping with it with humor. But it was very difficult at times hearing her making jokes, Colin said, like the hair jokes. And at some point, she made a joke about her arm getting amputated, and that was hard. As much as Sophie kept everyone laughing, her parents were also prepared for the other sorts of reactions they knew she could have. You have to be prepared for the other side of it, if she cries and rages, you know, because everything is fair, and so it's just trying to figure out how to quietly support her without overwhelming her, Katie said, because all I wanted to do was crawl into my bed and hold my baby. Sophie's surgeon initially thought she might need a combination of treatments, including surgery, chemo, and radiation. Ultimately, though, it was determined Sophie would only need surgery. Her surgeon said, "I can treat her here, this here in Peoria. You will have the same outcome. This is very manageable. But St. Jude wants her to go to Memphis to have her participate in research studies. And when St. Jude calls, you go," Katie said. Experience at St. Jude. A few days after agreeing to receive treatment and participate in elective research at St. Jude, Sophie and her family drove down to Memphis to begin the process. She was a rock star. She did all the testing, all the scans and appointments. We did orientation down there. And in that 72 hours, they did all the testing, got results, and came up with a plan, Katie said. The first thing the Osterbergs noticed about St. Jude was the level of care and assistance given to patients and their families, they said. Just a few days after they arrived home from their first trip to Memphis, they received a notification in their St. Jude app that Sophie had more appointments scheduled for the next day. "I called their patient services hotline and said, 'Hey, we're not on campus.' And they said, 'Can you get here?' And I said, 'What are our options?' And they gave us flight information. I picked a flight, and within 4 hours, the girls and I were on a flight," Katie said. One key way St. Jude makes an oftentimes overwhelming experience just a bit easier for families is providing everything they need to get the treatment their children need, the Osterbergs said. They take care of housing. They take everything to stay on campus. They take care of food. They give us a credit card for incidentals, like $20 a day, for things like you forgot to pack," Colin said. "They took everything out of our hands. We didn't have to worry about any of that stuff. The cost of treatments is also covered by St. Jude, as the Osterbergs learned. At St. Jude, children and families never see a bill," Katie said, "and you don't quite comprehend that until it happens. When we were down there doing all the testing, I kept getting phone calls from our insurance denying the testing. And at one point, our oncologist said, 'Oh, we really like it when insurance pays, and we don't care if they do.'" St. Jude is able to provide cost-free care to the children they treat thanks to a group who originally helped to start the research hospital in 1962 by Lebanese-American actor Danny Thomas. The story goes that Thomas prayed to St. Jude Thaddeus, the patron saint of lost causes, to help him when he had only $7 and his wife was in the hospital giving birth. He made the same prayer many times throughout his life, and every time his prayer was answered, he gave more and more of his money to charity. He made a vow that if St. Jude would help him, he'd build a temple for the saint. In the 1950s, he started just that through his work to establish the Children's Research Hospital, the first fully desegregated hospital in the South. Thanks to St. Jude's work researching child cancers, the survival rate has jumped from 20% when they first opened to 80% today, according to their website. The American Lebanese Syrian Associated Charities, ALSAC, exists solely to raise funds and awareness necessary to run St. Jude. The nonprofit estimates that the group will have to raise about 89% of the funds necessary to sustain and grow St. Jude, thanks to their generous donors. Throughout their experience with St. Jude, the family has continued to be awed by the amount of dedication and care they are shown by everyone, from nurses to doctors to staff members. Around 8 o'clock that first night, we came back in and the ladies at reception were like, "Oh, you guys got smiles on your faces." And we said, "Well, we got good news," Colin said. When they had checked us in the night before and we were all looking down, but the support was everywhere. Even the people of Memphis showed special attention and care to St. Jude families, the Osterbergs said. They see Sophie's wristband, and it's like everywhere you go in Memphis, there's somebody giving you free stuff, Katie said. Juggling responsibilities. In the midst of the trips back and forth to Memphis for Sophie's surgeries and appointments, the Osterbergs were also planning to celebrate their eldest daughter's high school graduation. At one point, they weren't sure if they would make it to her graduation. When we first went down there, we spent a week. We didn't know how long we'd be there, Colin said. I had all these end-of-school events. It was my last week of high school, so it was hard to not have everyone there for it. But my family did a good job of still being there for me while dealing with this, Emma said. I couldn't ask for anything else because they did the best they could. The Osterberg family is very involved in local nonprofit organizations. Katie runs Peer Court, for example, and she, along with her mother, Deanne Ryan, have been instrumental in helping to organize local support for community organizations that serve the underprivileged. But when it comes to accepting help, it's not always easy. We took a motto of, we aren't going to say no to help. So when people offered us help, we were going to say yes. Whatever people offered us, we were going to say yes, Colin said. Thankfully, the family was able to make it all work out thanks to help from friends and family. We were coming up with 100 contingency plans to make it work, Katie said, adding that a friend came over and cleaned their home ahead of the graduation party, while her brother had pizza catered so they wouldn't have to worry about feeding everyone, and the neighbor mowed the lawn while they were out of town. We wanted to make Emma's graduation special for her, Katie said, and we were able to just celebrate her. Even then, Sophie's humor enhanced the experience for everyone, they said. I asked myself, what can I do to make Emma's graduation all about me, Sophie said, laughing. And then I realized I already had it with my cancer diagnosis. The whole family laughed. Looking forward, when Sophie's second surgery at St. Jude was successful, and the family headed home, there were only 3 weeks left in the school year, so Sophie attended school remotely as she healed. I miss my friends so dearly, Sophie said. Thankfully, Danville High School was understanding of the situation and happy to work with the family, Katie said. Mr. Bretz, the principal, and her guidance counselor, and all of her teachers were incredibly accommodating and supportive. Most of my teachers just stopped giving me work, so that's good, Sophie said. After her recovery, she was able to land a spot on the Palmettes team this fall, which she's looking forward to. Now that Sophie has been declared cancer-free, the family can breathe easy, at least for now. Though her doctors do not anticipate Sophie's cancer returning, this diagnosis will be part of Sophie's story for the rest of her life. Thankfully, St. Jude patients are patients for life. Even as an adult for this cancer, her treatments will be done at St. Jude. So when she's in college, she can go live wherever she wants, and they're going to fly her to Memphis for her treatments and regular checkups, Katie said. The family was also able to cultivate connections with other St. Jude families who they look forward to seeing when they return in a few months for Sophie's first round of follow-up scans and treatments. They've even discovered there are other St. Jude families right here in Danville. I feel like things are finally getting back to normal a little bit. Everybody's less on edge all the time. We're kind of just like, okay, it was the best outcome we could have gotten, so all I can feel is grateful, Sophie said. Continuing with our news on page one, Salute, TAPS on Tuesday honors D-Day Army Private John Marvin Steele, again by our reporter Kayla White. A dozen or so people gathered together at Soldiers Circle at Spring Hill Cemetery Tuesday for the first TAPS on Tuesday event of the summer. As part of their ceremony, Fred Reinhardt, former history teacher and volunteer for the Vermilion County War Museum, shared a special presentation about Army Private John Marvin Steele, a paratrooper from the 82nd Airborne Division who participated in D-Day. On June 5, 1944, the night before D-Day, Steele and other paratroopers from the 1st and 2nd Battalion's 505th Parachute Infantry Regiment were directly dropped over the small village of Sainte-Mère-Église in Normandy, France. Steele, who hailed from Metropolis, Illinois, was supposed to join his comrades in taking control of the area in order to facilitate the offensive attack planned at dawn on Utah Beach, 10 kilometers away, a long bloody siege which would later come to be known as D-Day. Bombs are going off, artillery's going off, and so there's some confusion, and the 82nd Airborne is not supposed to drop directly into Sainte-Mère-Église, but some elements do, Reinhardt said. Due to a series of unfortunate events that led to fires in the village that night, when Steele was dropped by air above the church, Notre Dame, his parachute caught on the steeple of the church. Because of the fires, the whole village was outside when the drop happened. While Reinhardt spoke, he held up a framed photograph of the church, which had been signed by the mayor of the village and donated to the museum in 1999. Several buildings are on fire, so the Germans can see the paratroopers dropping down, and they are shooting them While they're floating down, Reinhardt said. So now he's hanging. He's wounded, and he's going to play dead. He is there for about 2 hours until two German soldiers notice him and they capture him. Thankfully, Steele later escaped his captors and went on to fight in the rest of World War II. He died in 1969 at the age of 57, but not before returning to the site of his crash landing in 1964 and being given honorary citizenship to the village of Sainte-Marie-Glace, which his bravery had helped to liberate from German invasion. A movie was made in 1962 about Steele's experience called The Longest Day, featuring actor Red Buttons reportedly in the starring role, acting work which Steele reportedly said was well done, according to the U.S. Army's official website article honoring Steele. Reinhardt visited the site in 2010 as part of a World War II tour, where he took photos of a dummy that still hangs on the side of the church's steeple, honoring Steele. I turned the corner and lo and behold, there's John Steele still hanging from the steeple, Reinhardt said, adding that Sainte-Marie-Glace was the first village liberated on D-Day. So they take great pride in being liberated by this 82nd Airborne by the United States. The church has even removed their old stained glass window of Jesus, Mary, and the disciples and replaced them with ones depicting paratroopers, Reinhardt said. After Reinhardt's presentation, Larry Weatherford, who runs the Vermilion County War Museum, where the donated and signed photo of the church still hangs, thanked him for his speech. I think it's always good to go to a place where something actually did happen and share it with people, because when you've done that, it helps us almost go there ourselves. So thank you again for joining us here at Taps on Tuesday, Weatherford said. Taps was then played by a special radio fitted inside a bugle, as the group's live bugle player was unable to attend that evening. Taps on Tuesday will take place every Tuesday this summer at Soldiers Circle in Spring Hill Cemetery. All are welcome to attend and honor those interred there. Our final story on the front page this week comes to us about the state of Illinois, with the headline, Pritzker Defends Illinois Immigration Laws, by Ben Zielinski from the Capital News, Illinois. Governor J.B. Pritzker spent hours Thursday, June 12th, defending his governing record and Illinois' immigration policies as he was peppered with questions from members of the U.S. House Oversight Committee. Pritzker and Democratic Governors Kathy Hochul of New York and Tim Walz of Minnesota were summoned to Washington, D.C. by Committee Chair James Comer, a Republican from Kentucky, to answer questions about sanctuary states. The hearing mostly involved lectures from Republican members arguing immigration policies like Illinois' diminish public safety, while Democratic members blasted the Trump administration's deportation raids. I invited these governors here today because, as the chief executives of their states, they willfully ignore federal law, shield illegal aliens, and pass the cost of free services onto their hardworking taxpayers, Comer said. It's hard to figure out whose side these governors are on. They shield criminals while their own citizens pay the price. Pritzker countered by reiterating a point he has made publicly in Illinois several times since November's election. As I have consistently said, violent criminals have no place on our streets. And if they are undocumented, I want them out of Illinois and out of our country, Pritzker said. And as we are reminded in Los Angeles this week, we can all agree that violence of any kind, whomever it is directed at, is unacceptable. Pritzker's appearance before the committee came as nationwide protests grew over the Trump administration's deportation tactics and increasing arrest numbers by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, especially in Los Angeles. After protests and violence in that city last weekend prompted President Donald Trump to deploy hundreds of troops, thousands of people marched through the streets of Chicago this week protesting immigration raids. Some protesters briefly clashed with police, and 17 people were arrested, according to Chicago police. Dozens more protests are planned in Chicago and around Illinois on Saturday. Dubbed as No King protests, the gatherings are designed to contrast with a military parade planned by Trump in Washington on Saturday, celebrating the U.S. Army's 250th birthday. Saturday is also Trump's 79th birthday. Pritzker said, if the Illinois National Guard ever needs to be activated to quell civil unrest, it's done in coordination with local law enforcement. He criticized Trump's deployment of the Guard in Los Angeles. It's wrong to deploy the National Guard and active duty Marines into an American city over the objection of local law enforcement just to inflame a situation and create a crisis, Pritzker said. Republicans on the committee allege sanctuary state laws violate federal immigration laws. Illinois 2017 Trust Act, signed by Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, prohibits Illinois law enforcement from detaining people based on their immigration status and assisting in civil immigration enforcement. Law enforcement cannot hold people based on federal immigration warrants in most cases, but they can make arrests for federal criminal warrants. Representative Gary Palmer, Republican, Alabama, suggested the three governors be criminally charged with obstruction because of their state's laws. His comments follow Trump's suggestion that California Governor Gavin Newsom should be arrested. "I have the highest duty to protect the people of my state, and indeed if Tom Homan were to come to my state and try to arrest us, me rather, I can say first of all that he can try," Pritzker said of Trump's border czar. "I can also tell you I will stand in the way of Tom Homan going after people who don't deserve to be frightened in their community." Homan told CNN earlier this week Newsom hasn't done anything to require an arrest. Controversy for Illinois immigration policies. Pritzker blamed decades of federal government inaction on immigration and border security for exacerbating issues in the U.S. He also acknowledged to Comer that President Joe Biden inadequately handled immigration, particularly as 50,000 migrants were sent to Illinois mostly by the governor of Texas. "We're not in charge of the border in Illinois, I can tell you that," Pritzker later told Representative Pete Sessions, a Republican from Texas. "We don't have a border with a foreign country. We had 50,000 people who came from Texas because they were shipped to us. And let me tell you, I was in favor of helping them." Pritzker occasionally butted heads with Republicans throughout the hearing. Comer questioned the governor about the death of Katie Abraham in an Urbana car crash. She was killed in January by a suspected drunk driver illegally in the United States, according to WCIA. The GOP members mentioned several crime victims by name throughout the hearing. Representative Mary Miller, a Republican from Hinsboro, accused Pritzker of rolling out the red carpet for illegal aliens, adding, "Illegal aliens in our state have overwhelmed our communities." "I'm not going to be lectured by someone who extolled the virtues of Adolf Hitler," Pritzker said, alluding to comments Miller made on January 6, 2021. Given multiple scenarios about what should happen to people who commit crimes while illegally in the country, Pritzker reiterated he supports deporting violent people, but emphasized that must happen with due process. Democrats have argued Trump's administration is deporting people without due process. Republicans also criticized Illinois' recent budgets for providing more than $1 billion of state health care benefits to people without documentation, along with other programs for non-citizens. However, Pritzker is expected to sign a new state budget this month that eliminates $330 million health care program for immigrants between ages 42 and 64. "You do not keep track of any public service dollars in the state of Illinois that goes to illegal immigrants?" Representative Brian Donalds from Florida asked Pritzker after the governor didn't offer specifics about exactly how much Illinois spends on illegal immigration. And while Pritzker cast some blame on Republican-led border states for making Illinois part of recent waves of millions of migrants, Representative Andy Biggs, a Republican from Arizona, remarked that while Illinois didn't ask for this crisis, as Pritzker said in his opening remarks, neither did Yuma, Arizona. The hearing's message. The hearing veered off topic several times. Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy, a Schaumburg Democrat, praised Pritzker's work on the economy and spent time discussing Pope Leo XIV's White Sox loyalty, while Texas Republican Representative Brandon Gill asked Pritzker whether he ever used a woman's restroom. "You're admitting that this is just a political circus, Pritzker responded to Gill. Aside from Gill's questions about bathrooms, Pritzker largely avoided any immigration-related viral moments. The most intense grilling was reserved for Walls, as the Democrats' 2024 vice presidential nominee and Hochul over high-profile murders in New York. Representative Nancy Mace, a Republican from South Carolina, remarked the hearing featured a possible preview of the 2028 Democratic presidential primary. Pritzker and Walls were both viewed as possible candidates in the next presidential election. Pritzker's appearance at the committee hearing is the latest opportunity to grow his national profile. His schedule throughout 2025 has been dotted with national media interviews and out-of-state speaking engagements, where he has often called for more protests of the Trump administration. He echoed that message again on Thursday. Well, the first page took us way past our halfway point today, so let's take a break from the news and look at our death notices that were received by 5 o'clock on Friday. There are two. In Watsika, Roberta Evelyn Maudlin, age 91, passed away on May 20th. Her visitation will be from 9 to 10 a.m. on August 8th at the United Methodist Church in Cisna Park, with a service at 10 a.m. on August 8th at the church. She will have a private burial at Crown Hill Cemetery in Georgetown. Our second death notice of the week, from Covington, Indiana, Deota Gerling, age 98, passed away on June 9th at her home. Visitation will be from 10 a.m. noon, and these times are Eastern, on Wednesday, July 9th at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Covington, and we have missed those services as of this reading. Her burial was at noon on the 9th in Mount Hope Cemetery. And that concludes our death notices for this week. Well, let's take a look at an event that's coming up this week that may be of interest to those of you that love gardening. Program focuses on vital horticultural relationship. The University of Illinois Extension horticulture educator Ryan Pankow will present a free program exploring the essential connection between plants and pollinators on Tuesday, June 17th at 6 p.m. at the Danville Public Library at 319 North Vermilion Street. This presentation will shed light on the often overlooked world of pollination and its critical role in both food production and ecosystem health. Pankow will discuss the wide variety of pollinators, from bees and butterflies to hummingbirds and beetles, and the ways in which they support biodiversity and human life. Without pollinators, our world would look very different, Pankow said. So many of the foods we enjoy every day, like apples and cherries and zucchini, rely on the work of pollinators. But beyond that, they play an essential role in sustaining entire plant communities and the wildlife that depends on them. Pollinators contribute to approximately 35% of global food production and are also essential in the creation of medicines, dyes, and natural fibers. In North America, the vast majority of pollinators are insects, with bees taking the lead. However, flies, wasps, moths, beetles, butterflies, and even hummingbirds all play important roles in maintaining the balance of our natural world. For more information about this program or to get registered, go to illinois.edu/pollinatorgarden. And again, that is at Tuesday, June 17th at 6 p.m. at the Danville Public Library. In our last minutes together, let's take a little bit of look at the history of Father's Day. All of this I did not know. This is brought to us by Charles Apple of the Spokesman Review. On January 19th, 1910, 115 years ago, churches and businesses in Spokane, Washington took time to celebrate their fathers. Here's how a Spokane daughter sold area residents on the idea and then took Father's Day national. On December 6th in 1907, a coal mine explosion in West Virginia kills 362 miners. 250 of them are fathers who leave behind about 1,000 fatherless children. The very next year, on July 5th in 1908, one of those children, Grace Golden Clayton, suggests to her pastor, Robert T. Webb of Williams Memorial Methodist Episcopal Church in South in Fairmont, West Virginia, that they hold a special memorial service for those fathers. A memorial is held, but it's local and a one-time event. Go another year forward to May 9th of 1909, and while listening to a Mother's Day sermon, 27-year-old Sonora Smart Dodd of Spokane has the idea of having a similar day to honor fathers. Her own father, William Jackson Smart, was a Civil War veteran and a widower who raised her and her five younger brothers, and her mother died in childbirth with the fifth brother. Sonora was just 16 when that happened. And the first Father's Day was observed on June 19, 1910 in Spokane. Dodd delivers gifts to handicapped fathers. Boys from the YMCA wear roses on their lapels, red for those with living fathers, and white for deceased. Special sermons on fatherhood are presented in Presbyterian and Methodist churches in Spokane, and the day is observed throughout the state of Washington thanks to a proclamation by Governor M.E. Hay. Fast forward to 1913, and a bill to introduce a National Father's Day is introduced in Congress by Representative Hampton Moore. Moore introduces the bill at the suggestion of Charlotte Kickbrick of Philadelphia, who has worked to have Father's Day observed in many parts of the country. President Woodrow Wilson approves the resolution that makes Mother's Day an official celebration 6 years after it was proposed in 1914. And President Wilson honors Spokane's Father's Day celebration by using a special telegraph key set up on his desk in the White House in 1916. It wasn't until 1966 that President Lyndon Johnson issues an executive order designating the third Sunday in June as Father's Day. I hope you all celebrated well. Well, that was a very fast 30 minutes. Let's take a look at our 7-day forecast. It looks like Sunday and Monday, we're going to have some humidity with some sun with highs in the mid-80s. Tuesday, thunderstorm in the evening. Wednesday, some rain and thunderstorms. Those days have highs in the upper 80s. And then we return to sunny skies on Thursday with some high 79. Friday, back to the humid and heat, high of 87. This is Terry Burdick reading from you the Commercial Danville News. Have a great week.